Today on Wings, feminist art activists wearing gorilla masks take over an American city.
Things were getting worse and worse for women after the gains that artists made, and particularly feminist artists, in the 1960s and 1970s. And a bunch of women artists went to this demonstration in front of the Museum of Modern Art in New York because they had a show that included almost no women artists and almost no artists of color. And we saw that nobody cared. And we were trying to think of a disguise so we could be in public and talk to people and do press interviews.
And we wanted to be anonymous to protect ourselves, but distancing ourselves personally from the issue so that people couldn't say, she's complaining because she didn't get this or that. And then we could also represent the condition of women artists, not the condition of a single individual.
And one of our early members, a terrible speller, you know, the word in English, gorilla, the animal, is kind of like gorilla, the freedom fighter. So she's writing gorilla. And we thought, oh my God, this is it.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This is Dixie Treichel. I'm sitting in an undisclosed location in downtown Minneapolis, speaking with two of the masked gorilla girls, Kata and Frida, who always wear gorilla masks to protect their anonymity and to keep the focus on the issues, not their identities. Formed in 1985 as an activist art collective, the Gorilla Girls are devoted to exposing gender, racial, and economic inequality within the art world. They're visiting Minneapolis for the 2016 Gorilla Girls Twin Cities Takeover, which includes projections, posters, and public events.
I'm Kata Kolwitz. I'm one of the founders of the Gorilla Girls, and I've been involved with pretty much everything we've done all these years from 1985 until today. Most of us are artists. I'm an artist, and we've had over 55 members over the years, and they've been a diverse group. We've had cis members, trans members, LGBTQ members, and people from lots of different kinds of backgrounds.
I'm Frida Kahlo. I'm also a founding member of the Gorilla Girls, and I've been involved, as Kata has been, in just about everything the girls have done.
The Gorilla Girls began because we realized that women artists and artists of color weren't getting exhibited very much in the art museums and galleries. So you decided to do something about it.
Well, you know, it's all part of a system. In 1985, the Museum of Modern Art reopened after a renovation. And the first show was an international survey of painting and sculpture. And out of nearly 200 artists in the show, there were only 17 women and even fewer artists of color. And the curator said a very arrogant thing that, you know, anyone who wasn't in the show should rethink his career. That was an aha moment. We thought, whoa. You know, it's pretty clear. You know, there's some kind of discrimination going on here. So we went up and joined a group of women artists. No, they weren't just women, they were people, lots of people, protesting in front of the museum with placards and chants and, you know, a picket line. And at the end of the day, Kata and I went together. We realized that we hadn't accomplished anything, but we made everybody going inside the museum angry because they really thought that the art world and the museums were a meritocracy. So we vowed that day that we would find some new ways, some new strategies to get people talking about this issue that they didn't think was important. We wanted to make it important to them.
We thought that there were so many media-savvy ways to get through to people. And we called a bunch of people together and named ourselves the Gorilla Girls. And we had this idea, even before the first meeting, to do posters. A certain kind of poster that kind of twisted an issue around and presented it in a different way than does a lot of political art. So at the first meeting, we had the first posters. We passed the hat around to pay for printing, put them up on the streets of New York City, and all hell broke loose. We thought nothing would happen, but instead, here we are today after all this time.
And, you know, a lot of really progressive people in the art world had never really thought about this issue. And I'm talking about artists, curators, critics, and even some women artists had not really thought about it.
Or were they trying to deny it?
Well,
because there was a movement in the 70s, a big feminist protest movement in art. So it wasn't that people didn't know about it. They were denying. They wanted to run away from it and deny it.
My point being that we had to figure out a way to transform people's thinking. We couldn't just point to it and say, this is bad. We had to create a kind of dialogue about it. We had to make people care and make people argue with one another and disagree. And so we staged a lot of posters that would just ask questions. And then the answer was sort of in the mind of the beholder. It was actually fun to put a poster up on a Friday night and then go out on Saturday afternoon and hang out near the posters and listen to people argue about them.
You started the Guerrilla Girls in 1985, so that means you grew up partly in the 70s. Did you have any experiences as a female artist being rejected, or did you find you were not represented?
Just to go back to that time, in New York City, there were a lot fewer galleries and even fewer museums than there are now. And almost none of them showed women artists or artists of color. It just didn't exist. It was almost all white males, white males, white males, white males. So of course we noticed this. I mean, there was no place to show our work. In fact, a whole network of alternative ways to show work grew at that time because there were no opportunities for people like us.
And actually, in art schools at that time, it wasn't unusual to have more than 50% of the graduating class women. And of course, 90% or 95% of the professors were male. And of course, we all know what that led to. So I think there was a whole generation of women trained to be artists. They got out of school and there were no opportunities for them. That was really annoying. And for a long time, I think women took it on themselves that there was something deficient about themselves. And we realized, No, we're ready, we're trained, the system is wrong. And so we attacked the system.
And in our group, you know, we've always had members who have been quite successful in the art world. So it wasn't that we were speaking without knowing that the art world sucks, you know, the system sucks, but the world of artists is really great. And we all know that here, we're all artists of different kinds, and you put your whole life into your work, and there's such great work out there. There's no lack of great work. There's just a system set up to cast the narrowest net possible instead of the widest, which it should be doing.
Well, whenever we did our posters, we went after one sort of subgroup in the art world after another. First, we went after, you know, our fellow artists, and we said, what do these artists have in common? And the answer was they allow their work to be shown in galleries that show fewer than 10% women artists or none at all. And on that list, there were some very progressive political artists who had never really incorporated that, incorporated that into their work. And of course the artists would say, oh, but my galleries don't show women. Then we went after the galleries. And then the galleries said, well, you know, no one writes about women artists. So then we went after the critics. And the critics said, well, how can we, you know, write about them when they're not curated into shows? So we went after the curators. And the curators would basically say, well, no one's buying these artists. So why, you know, they're not. So we went after every group in the art world. We put everyone on edge. We put everyone, we made everyone accountable for it. And we made them talk about, you know, I mean, they said some pretty ridiculous things. I mean, one gallery owner said, you know, women and artists of color are just not making the kind of work that's part of the art dialogue now. And that was so unbelievable. They wouldn't say it now. I mean, you know, exclusion is a little more coded now, and it has more to do with money. But early on, we noticed that the Whitney Biennial was just rife with, the number of women artists was decreasing in the Whitney Biennial, which was weird, and we couldn't understand that. But we also noticed that the size of the biennial kept getting smaller and smaller. So we realized there was something going on in the art world that was about collecting.
Creating superstars rather than having more artists.
When do you think that superstar mentality started?
I think there was always a tradition, or in a way a fake construct of, the art is really about one great genius after another. with no regard for the fact that every so-called genius is part of his, her, their own time and subject to the forces of it and influenced by their own time. So to us, it's much more interesting to look at the society of each time, to kind of examine that kind of thing. But also, after we started doing all these posters that Frida was talking about, we realized that we had kind of invented this game-changing way of talking about issues and being in your face and having an effect. And we immediately started applying that to other issues, not just issues in the art world. We started applying it to anti-war things, to the fight in this country, you know, the horrible fight in this country against abortion, women's reproductive rights, and all kinds of tokenism and all kinds of different issues.
After you started doing your activism, what did you see change? Did you find a different way to speak about art?
Well, the language always changes and the vocabulary always changes. But I would say that pretty soon the press was kind of doing our job for us, because in covering us, you know, they had to talk about the issue. And we never had a 5-year plan. We never thought we would be doing this forever. We did not know that it would become a career in of itself. We were just, you know, everything, it kept getting more and more interesting, and we kept going after things. I think what surprised us is when multiculturalism became part of the dialogue, and particularly as funding was involved, because when there's, you know, when there's public funding, you have to be representative. So we saw museums showing one woman artist or one artist of color and then thinking the problem was taken care of. And we noticed it was the same one woman artist and the same one, you know, artist of color being shown over and over again. So we started to think about tokenism. We had no idea that that would become a problem, you know, an issue. And our idea was, is tokenism a solution or is it just an extension of the problem of exclusion? And then came the glass ceiling. You know, finally some women and some artists of color were allowed into the, you know, through the gates, and they became part of the canon. They weren't given the same resources or the same rewards. There was a lot of, you know, economic inequality. And how can you really keep up in the art world when, you know, your work is selling for 10% of what someone else's does? So that was something we hadn't imagined. And now, you know, art has become an asset class. It's become an investment. People are as fixated on the rising, ever-ending value of art more than the content. So you see all this coverage about how much things sold for at auction, and you realize that sometimes artists, let's admit, you know, they drink the Kool-Aid and they play to that audience, and we think that what gets sold at auction for $100 million is really representative of our culture, and it's not. I mean, until what museums collect, until what is written as art history looks like the culture, it's just a history of money and power. It's not a history of who we are.
On Wings, you're listening to an interview with feminist art activists from the world-famous Guerrilla Girls. They came to Minneapolis to be part of a year-long feminist art takeover in collaboration with women artists and institutions in the region. They call themselves by names from women's art history, Kitta Kollwitz and Frida Kahlo. The interviewer is Dixie Treichel.
I think the idea of rewriting history is really important. How do you think this should be approached?
Well, there's so much feminist scholarship now that's refound artists from the past, and their stories are amazing. They're really interesting. We have a project at MIA right now where we talk about one artist who's been totally forgotten from the 19th century, Rosa Bonheur, who presented as male her whole life and had a permit from the French police to do this. And she did amazing, huge paintings of animals and things like that. We actually were in Paris a few years ago, the Guerrilla Girls were, and we went to visit her house, which is now a museum, which we recommend to people. It was really, really an incredible experience. It's about an hour outside of Paris. But another thing we did was we wrote our own art history book. First, we kind of took the books, the kind of old textbooks from high school and early college, you know, Janssen's History of Art, etc. And we altered their covers to make it Janssen's History of Mostly Male Art, you know, Janssen's History of White Male Art, etc. And then we wrote our own damn book where we did it kind of like what you're saying. We wanted to describe the lives of these women who managed to break the rules and become artists all through Western art history. This book was only about that, although we want to expand it in the future, you know, and do something about a lot of different cultures. And we found people we didn't know about. We researched them. We read about them. People in our group took names. You know, when you had to take a pseudonym, each of us has a pseudonym of a dead woman artist. And a lot of times they would go and find somebody, maybe an artist, maybe a poet, maybe someone else who they never heard of before, and then we would all know about them.
And their stories were pretty wonderful, and I think it's clear that the male canon didn't know what to do with these women, even the ones who were very successful in their lives. They sort of got written out of the history because, you know, they broke all the rules. I mean, one example is Claude Cahun. Claude Cahun was a photographer, born Lucy Schwab, adopted the name Claude Cahun, and then took pictures, self-portraits, in every kind of, you know, gender possibility you can imagine. Of course, Claude Cahun was eliminated from all of the Surrealist shows, and actually some books on Surrealism, some of them list Claude Cahun as a woman, some list her as a man. And we think it's really interesting that art history doesn't have a place for that, but it's so important. Those sorts of stories are so important right now, you know, with the whole trans movement and the idea that all of these people have been here, and they've been part of our culture and our history, and they need to be included.
And they're fantastic role models for young artists. You know, that's what we all look for when we're young. You see work, and it just gets you so much. It changes your worldview. I mean, art definitely has the power to do that.
Joining us is one of the organizers of the Guerrilla Girls Twin Cities Takeover.
My name's Joan Vorderbergen, and I'm the Cultural District Arts Coordinator for Hennepin Theater Trust.
Joan, talk about how this project came about.
2 years ago, Megan Johnston, who is the Executive Director of the Rochester Arts Center, instigated this idea that she'd implemented before in Ireland with the Guerrilla Girls to do a really large-scale collaborative project with many large institutions here in the Twin Cities, but also considering other smaller galleries, educational institutions, and teen groups. And when the conversation initially started, and the first time you were here, I was very, very new to the art scene here in the Twin Cities. I'd been a local arts administrator, kind of DIY community arts person, and I'd collaborated with the Guerrilla Girls in 2012. They'd created a really great anti-marriage amendment billboard that was funded by the local arts community. So myself and lots of other artists sort of campaigned to get a small amount of money together to get them to work with us. And we did this great billboard together, as well as some postering of the voter amendment, which were both voted down, happy to say. But so when the Guerrilla Girls came here for this first conversation contemplating this large takeover, they didn't see me on their agenda, yet they remembered having worked with me. And so it was really amazing that they sort of reached out to me separate of all of the institutions and said, we want to talk to you too. And lo and behold, I was just new in this position here at Hennepin Theater Trust to activate Hennepin Avenue with art and artists. And so, of course, that is a very great platform for arts activism in the public. So we got really aspirational right away.
We love working on the streets.
Yeah.
We've done street projects all over the world. And it's just great having something out there that people can interact with or not. You know, it's up to them. And often they do. Our incredible wall that Joan found for us has a 60-foot banner about the Oscars. You see people out there looking at it. They come over. You know, if we're there, they come over and talk. It's just been really amazing.
But for your listeners, what it says is the anatomically correct Oscar.
He's a white male, like almost everyone who wins.
It has statistics about the percentage of awards that have have not gone to people of color in the film industry. And then there's that we redesigned the Oscar to kind of look like an aging white male.
Little flabby.
Yeah, a little bald.
Hairy.
It's so great.
Little hairy. Very pale.
And covering his privates.
Yes.
Only because it's on the street.
And we have two more. And we have two more billboards that are going up about the Oscars. And it was great to do that, to put them up the day of the Oscar, just a week before International Women's Day.
And so this has been really exciting to do public realm activation. It's also where I started out as a storefront artist and working more into the public realm and working with muralists and street artists. So for me to be able to provide this canvas of Hennepin Avenue in downtown for kind of the final arm of the Guerrilla Girl year-long takeover. So there's a Walker exhibit, there's an exhibit at Mia, and then there's all these other artists. There's 20 different galleries across the Twin Cities featuring exhibitions by individual artists and group shows that are inspired by the Guerrilla Girls or inspired by activism through the arts. So it's just like this amazing surge of energy through this large-scale collaboration. We have 8 different youth groups from across the Twin Cities that created digital pieces, either video or slideshows, to take over our Made Here project on Hennepin to join the Guerrilla Girls in their public activation and do public activation featuring activism as well. So we're really getting a huge number of varied voices in the conversation, both in the public realm activation as well as all of the events happening all over the Twin Cities. So this week is Hennepin Takeover Week, or the Takeover Week. And so every night of the week, there's just a handful of different things that people can either go to or participate in. And so it's really exciting. And I have to say that as an administrator coming from this administrative side, working for a larger institution, one of the most fascinating things, besides, you know, being able to work with the Guerrilla Girls, which itself is really rewarding, but having this collaborative force of all of these different women who come from The Walker, MCAD, MIA, Rochester Arts Center, a million others I'm forgetting, but meeting with them regularly over the course of the last 2 years has been incredibly valuable and special. And realizing what we can do when we are more outfacing with our institutions, what we can accomplish together, and how much we can get done as women who are leaders in the arts here in the Twin Cities. So that's been, I think, probably the biggest gift of the entire year-long project.
It's huge. I mean, huge.
What is your message about feminism?
It's not just women we're talking to. You know, we're talking about inclusion. Feminism is for women, it's for men, it's for LGBTQ, it's for everyone, because it is the force that tells us equal rights are human rights, and none of us are free until all of us are free. Our stage is the world of culture. And until culture looks like our culture, when I say culture, I mean when what you see in museums, when what you see in films, when you see what you see in theater, what you hear at the opera, you know, until it looks like who we are, it's not our history. And we have to continually make the establishment feel shameful, embarrassed, and guilty.
First of all, understand the system, investigate the system, be an activist against the system. Because the art system right now really is set up just to anoint a few and make everyone else feel like crap. And that's something you have to fight every day in your own work as an artist. So don't try to fit in, you know. The second thing is, however, join with other people to make trouble so that there is more diversity, because that's going to help everyone. And the third thing is, so many artists are finding new media and new ways of doing art, new, totally new hybrids, you know, music and art, performance and art, film and art. Art only online, art that goes out to a ton of people, you know. We need to get rid of the gatekeepers, and of course, that's going to be a slow process. So don't be demoralized. Find ways for you to ignore the gatekeepers. I mean, sure, I hope everybody has a hugely successful career in the art world as we know it today. But don't forget to also be in other places, join together with people in other places.
And I might take that a little bit further and say, make the art world you want to live in. Don't accept the art world that, you know, that is. You know, we have our funny little financial economic model that has nothing to do with the way most other artists live. You know, they want to go to the right schools, get the right galleries, be in the right, you know, in the right museums and have their work sell for millions of dollars and go to cocktail parties with billionaires. You know, we're kind of not interested in that. We want our work to be accessible and as direct as possible to everyone. So we sell t-shirts and books and we go on lecture tours and, you know, we don't do small public commissions. And we don't aspire to live like billionaires. We just want to be free to do what we're doing. And a really wonderful example of how, you know, art can, it doesn't have to be a leisure activity or something you do in your spare time. It really is an expression of your life. There were a group of homeless teens we worked with who have produced two of the most touching and wonderful videos that you can see all up and down Hennepin Avenue right now about their lives as homeless teenagers.
And artists, because they work with a group that where they do any kind of creative work that they want to do, and they're pretty incredible.
And it really is, it's touching, it's wonderful, and it was so meaningful for them to do this work.
And it's not just them, there are a lot of other great projects there too. It's great that this isn't just about us. And let's face it, it is hard to be an artist. The only great thing is you can't stop people from doing it. And if you could, we'd have no culture. Thank God that no matter how bad the system is and how many, you know, the powers that be out there want to get rid of all of us and have a lot less of us, that ain't happening. So we got to find ways to have great lives and make our work.
And don't take no for an answer.
And we are so excited to bookend all of this activity with just hundreds of artists and so many people who've been working so hard at the State Theater on Saturday, March 5th. We are excited to invite everybody to come down. The tickets are really inexpensive and accessible. We have Chastity Brown opening with an acoustic set, which is going to be really fun. And then the Gorilla Girls are going to produce a multimedia performance. And there's going to be an opportunity for people to ask questions. So there'll be a question and answer segment, which will be really exciting because I think that kind of improvisation will be something that you don't often get to do at the State Theater, for sure.
Yeah, we're going to talk about how our work has evolved over 30, 31 years, how the context has changed. And we'll do some readings from our work, and we'll present a couple of rants.
Will you give me a rant right now?
Well, shortly.
Be a loser! Don't participate in the hyper-competitive art world that only is about making celebrities. Get together with your friends and make trouble.
Thank you, Kata, Frida, and Joan. Thanks so much for speaking with me. And congratulations on celebrating 31 years of the Gorilla Girls. This is Dixie Trichel.
Feminist art activists known as Kata Kollwitz and Frida Kahlo were in Minneapolis for a regional feminist art takeover. For more about feminist art takeovers, visit GorillaGirls.com. Gorilla is spelled GERRILLA. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the new book, The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm series producer Frida Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.